So good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to welcome you all to this year's version of the Trottier Symposium. This has become a very, very important date within the McGill calendar. We have faculty, we have students, and we have members of the public. It's really quite difficult to capture all three groups in one symposium, but the nature of the Trottier Symposia each year is we're dealing with very important questions that affect both how we perform research, how we transmit research to the public, and how the public receives that research information. The symposium organizers have worked very hard this year. I've been in contact with them throughout the late summer and the fall to put together a fantastic program for these 2 days. And as per usual, they're dealing with some of the most pressing issues in science and science as it relates to the public interest. I'd like to introduce our principal and Vice Chancellor Suzanne Fortier. She'll make some opening remarks. I think it's very fitting that Principal Fortier does so, because it's not just that of her leadership role at McGill, but also her career-long role in doing research. She's a very accomplished researcher, but also her career-long promotion of scientific research, both in the national and the global context. She's delivered many inspiring messages to the McGill community since she's come back to McGill as principal. And I actually have one of these messages on my desktop. I had copied it, cut and pasted it from a Globe and Mail interview that she did soon after she took on the position as principal. And I have it there because I think it says something really important. It's something I remind myself of. I can only paraphrase it really at this point, but you know, what she says is that we have a responsibility in the university as researchers and as teachers, instructors, to exchange the knowledge among ourselves. That's the scientific core to the scientific method. But we also have to make sure that knowledge and expertise, she said, that we acquire as being researchers, is also shared with the community. That's the community is not just the public. The community is industry. It's everything outside of the university environment. So that message is one that I look at periodically, along with other aphorisms, and I think it's very fitting that Suzanne is able to open up this Trottier Symposium. So with that, I'd like to now call on Principal Fortier to introduce the symposium.
Bonsoir et bienvenue à vous tous au symposium Lorne Trottier, un symposium scientifique pour le public. C'est vraiment un grand plaisir de vous accueillir. Je pense que nous tous, à chaque année, nous anticipons d'ailleurs avec beaucoup de plaisir ce moment de l'année où on se rencontre. Et j'aimerais en profiter pour remercier la famille Trottier de nous aider à partager ce moment-là ensemble, de nous appuyer dans le pargesse de ce moment-là ensemble. It's a really a moment that we await, all of us, every year, because, as you know, for the past 11 years now, we have been treated to talks by some of the world's best scientists about topics of science that are often not so easy and often also quite controversial. And so we are able to have a better understanding of these topics and a better way for ourselves to assess some of the scientific articles that we read in the newspapers or on the web. And I must say that myself, every year I kind of expect with some excitement what will be the topic this year, because every year there's a new topic and they're always extremely good topics. I just want to mention some of them. I know many of you have been to all of the symposium, but you may remember 2007, a cosmic coincidence. Why is the universe just right for life? That's an amazing topic, I thought. 2009 was avoiding dangerous climate change. This is very topical. And they were talking about geoengineering or mitigation. 2011 was about alternative medicine, and they put it under the microscope. In 14, oh, that's a fantastic topic. Are we alone and searching for life out there? I know my friend Julie here is one who's extremely interested in that topic, Julie Payette. And this year, a question of evidence, vaccines, GMOs, and cell phones. You know, there's so much scientific information that is readily available to all of us. But ease of access is great, but it's getting harder and harder for any of us to sort out the good from the bad, the information from the misinformation. And at the end, often we have to go back to the primary data source, to the evidence, to be able to make sense of it all. And in fact, this was what the introduction to the symposium on the web said. Arriving at a reasonable conclusion about controversial matters, therefore, comes down to one thing, a question of evidence. It is my great, great pleasure to introduce the moderator of the symposium, somebody who is very well known in our community, Dr. Joe Schwartz. Of course, Joe is known at McGill as the director of the Office of Science and Society. He's known also by the greater, larger public for all of his sharing of his knowledge in ways that are very accessible to all of us. He has very informative and also entertaining public lectures on topics that range from the chemistry of love to the science of aging. These are a very interesting topic for all of us. He's received many awards for his work, both as a professor of chemistry and as a person for sharing, for outreach to the public, science outreach to the public. And most recently, he was awarded the Robert P. Ball Annual Prize in Critical Thinking, and this was presented by the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, and this was for his book, Is That a Fact? This was actually a topic of one of the symposium. And of course, many of you know that you can hear Joe on radio every Sunday afternoon on CGADs. And that's the Dr. Joe Show. He's appeared many, many times on television, and he's also the author of many bestsellers, 15 bestsellers. The last one, which he published in May, is called Monkeys, Myths, and Molecules. And I'm told that he's already working on his next book, so there's more to come. But without any further delay, Dr. Joe Schwartz.
Thanks, Principal Fortier, for those kind remarks, and I'm getting better at the lecture on aging and taking more and more interest in that one. Okay, a question of evidence, and I've been puzzling over just how to get this going, and a definition seems to be in order, but a definition of evidence is not easy, and here's one that I've come up with. Although it's not all-encompassing, but we talk about data that's obtained through experiments or through just looking at the natural world. And we hope that we can find stuff that supports an assertion that's been made. However, as we well know, evidence is not white or black. It's various shades of gray. And this is where a lot of confusion arises. For example, let's face it. We know how to make cell phones. There's plenty of evidence. We each have one in our pocket. We know it works. We know how to make that. We know how to make vaccines. There's no question about that. We know how to genetically modify seeds. No question that this can be done. But the more interesting question is how these interface with biological systems and living organisms. And that's where things become much, much more questionable. It's very difficult to get the evidence that we really want. And there's just a couple of reminders that I would like to bring up before we get to the meat of the matter today. Sort of overall themes that we have to keep in mind whenever we talk about evidence. And that is that a lot of the studies are done on animals. But the human is not a giant rat, with some exceptions, of course. But by and large, it's not the case. And not everything is possible to extrapolate from animals. As we well know, if chocolate had been tested on dogs, we wouldn't be eating chocolate, because the dog is not a good model for that. So that's something to keep in mind. Also very important, children are not small adults. And I'm sure that Paul, who's a pediatrician, will attest that that's one of the first things you teach your medical students, right? Is that children are, it's a different species. And you can't just go by body weight and adjust your dose like that. So something that may be totally safe in an adult may throw a monkey wrench into the works if children are exposed. Also, as we well know these days, it is easy to cherry pick data, because there's so much stuff published, so much of it is not very good quality. But it's possible to kind of back up almost any kind of view that you have by cherry-picking literature. And on virtually every scientific study, there are opposing views. However, they are not necessarily equally weighted opposing views. And this is, unfortunately, something that doesn't come across properly in journalism, because reporters will very often interview an expert on one side, an expert on the other side, and write an article, and it kind of gives the impression that the two views are equally weighted. We also have to keep in mind that risk is something that we have to live with, and no matter what, you cannot get away from it. Everything that we do has a certain amount of risk associated with it. It just has to be properly evaluated. And the way we evaluate that is by looking at the evidence. And that, of course, is what we're going to do here over the next two evenings, is have our experts evaluate the evidence, weigh it. And, of course, we rely mostly on the peer-reviewed literature, because we hope that data that is submitted has been vetted by the experts before it gets published. But these days, there's a lot of peer-reviewed literature that isn't all that reliable. So we have to be skeptical here, too, and take a look at, you know, just what literature is worthwhile, what is important to look at, and what we can bypass. So what we want to do is distill out of data and follow the massive amount of literature that supports a specific view. And that's what we will do here over the next two evenings with our guests. Tomorrow night, we will tackle the thorny issues of radiation and its dangers, and of course cell phones will play an important role, and that's with Dr. Jeffrey Kabat. And he's comes to us from Yeshiva University, the Albert Einstein School of Medicine in New York. And Dr. Kevin Folta tomorrow night will address the topic of genetic modification. And he comes from the University of Florida. And that promises to be an interesting and spirited discussion. Tonight, we're going to examine the vaccination story, historically and current perspectives. And the first to speak tonight will be Dr. Brian Ward, who is one of our colleagues at McGill. He is McGill's expert on vaccination and immunology. He's a physician, and he regales us often at McGill with insights into just what is happening into this world, and today he will do that for you. And he will be followed by Dr. Paul Offit, who comes from Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, where he's a pediatrician, and not only is he an expert on vaccines, but he has also formulated vaccines which have saved numerous lives. So we're going to really hearing about vaccines from the horse's mouth, as they say. So I will first call on Brian to come up and give us a Canadian perspective on the vaccination issue.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Joe. Thank you to the Trache family for supporting this, President Forche. It took all my restraint, actually, not to bring pictures of one of the best graduate students who's gone through my lab, Claire Trache, and show you pictures of her in her younger days. I'm also not sure where Joe got this picture, because I think it was back when I got married. I'm a little grayer now. I'm going to talk to you about the Canadian scene, vaccine hesitancy, vaccine refusal. It's becoming a bigger problem, but before I do, I think it's essential that I mention conflicts of interest, and like most people working in vaccines in the academic setting, I actually have quite a few interactions, both with industry. I'm medical officer for a small biotech in Quebec City, consult for a number of companies, as well as governments in the area of vaccine compensation, both Canadian and U.S., have had contracts for vaccine trials, shared team grants and other grants with pharma, occasionally accept speakers honoraria, and unfortunately I have no investments. It's very interesting, actually, those of you, it's a Montreal-based audience, so you'll understand that the most serious conflict of interest I have is that I actually shared an award with the construction company SNC-Lavalin, which is implicated in some scandalous behavior, unfortunately, in the building of the new super hospital. Every year since I came to McGill in 1990, I've done something quite boring. For every medical class, first-year medical class, for every science class to deal with vaccines, before I've actually said anything else, I asked the class to raise their hands when I reach the number that represents their general appreciation of vaccines. So a zero is vaccines are tools of the devil. Vaccines should never be used in anybody at any time. No one's voted zero yet, which is quite good. And 10, vaccines are angel dust. They should all be used in everybody all the time. And blue dots are the medical class, and yellow dots are the science class. The red dot is a TEDx talk that I gave in 2009. To about 500 people in the MNI amphitheater from the general McGill community, not the scientists. About a third of the class, and at the end of this voting session, I asked the class to sort of tell me if I'm estimating approximately where they fell. A third of the people in the audience voted at 5 or below in that large TEDx talks, saying that vaccines are closer to tools of the devil than they are angel dust. And that's a massive problem for all of us in that general loss of confidence. This inspires frustration, despondency, and when anecdote continues to trump evidence, some of us actually just get really, really mad, right? But that's probably not an appropriate response, certainly not a professional response. So just to show you some data, it's very recent data, actually. I got it from Shelley Deeks. Is there something to be mad about in Canada? This is a very large study using school administrative databases. Ontario is one of the only provinces in the country where you have to actually show your vaccination status when you enter school. And in fact, these kind of data, this is diphtheria, tetanus, polio, measles, mumps, and rubella, vaccine status in 7-year-old kids, and we're running basically between 1 and 2% of non-vaccine coverage. These are numbers that would make our colleagues south of the border very jealous in general. Even more promising is that, in fact, the medical exemptions for vaccines have been dropping steadily over time as we learn more about the vaccines. So during this period of time, 85 to 2005, many new vaccines were actually introduced. And even though these vaccines were introduced, we're actually having fewer and fewer medical exemptions to vaccination. On the other hand, the number of people who are claiming religious or conscientious objector exemptions is actually slowly creeping up. These numbers are far below what you see in some jurisdictions south of the border, but they are worrisome in the Canadian context. And these are the best data we have. This was actually just published last week in CMAJ Open, the Canadian Medical Journal. Well, As reassuring as this is from the Canadian point of view, the herd that we live in fact, is North America, and in fact, it's the world. And so things that happen south of the border and in other places in the world also affect us. This was made very clear just earlier this year when there was a large measles outbreak starting in Disneyland, probably imported from the Philippines based upon genetic information that spread to several U.S. states as well as Canada. So it was brought back to Canada, and in fact, in Lanaudière region, just north of Montreal, we actually had 136 cases linked to the Disney outbreak. These people were almost all members of a religious group, La Mission de l'Esprit Saint, and almost all of these individuals had chosen to remain unvaccinated. And this is a repeating theme through the outbreak information. Many of the people in the Disney outbreak were unvaccinated. This Disney outbreak arrived in Canada and then explodes in these small bursts. Well, these vaccines have been around since the 1960s. And so that makes you ask the simple question, you know, are these people crazy? Well, they're not. This guy's crazy. But the people who are actually refusing vaccine, for the most part, are not really crazy in some sense. There are people who are shouting very loudly bad things about vaccines, and some of them come very close to textbook definition of crazy. Canada's most famous anti-vaccine spokespeople was Ghislaine Langteau. She published The Medical Mafia in 1994 when Quebec was introducing its hepatitis B vaccination program, and some people have estimated that she single-handedly reduced vaccine uptake for hepatitis B by 5 or 6%. Among other memorable notions of this pharmacist, actually, was the notion that Zionism, its international banking cartel, and their intent to implement a global dictatorship are a cancer on humanity which must be destroyed. She wrote this in her book, and yet she was taken seriously. And people listened to her. And this is a phenomenal problem. She reemerged in 2009 from her long silence on the subject of vaccination because of the H1N1 outbreak when she said that this was a pandemic concocted by the WHO and that the elite and their minions. I don't know, Paul, do you have many minions? You're not in the elite? Anyways, the elite and their minions will introduce a compulsory vaccination program that will contain a deadly virus that will be used specifically as a eugenics weapon for massive and targeted reduction of the world population, and that the pandemic will be used to further establish martial law and police state. Okay? When somebody is this far out, by the way, she's, I think, in jail now for not paying her taxes, but when somebody is this far out, they're easy to ignore. But the fact is, there are lots of people who are far cleverer than Ghislaine Langteau. And what we have, actually, is a small number of very committed individuals who have a megaphone in the internet, and they're able to talk. And they do. They talk. And what happens is, in this large population of people, these are the anti-vaccine committed, and these, light blue, are the anti-vaccine hesitant. And what we need to do is break this link between, this communication link between the vaccine opponents who are committed and the people who really just want to do the best for their children. These people, their primary goal in life is to create a debate, as Joe just said, because if they can achieve, no matter how uneven the debate, if they can achieve a situation where somebody, an arbitrator, a judge, a journalist can say, jump ball, they've won, because then they have more of a platform to speak. Well, is there a debate? It depends on how you define the word debate. If you define 99.99% of scientists on one side and 0.01 scientists on the other side as a debate, then yeah, I guess there is one. But on the internet, there's clearly a debate. This is a lovely paper published by Anna Cotta at McMaster in 2010, where she actually just did internet searches, either in the United States or in Canada, and looked at what the first 10 websites came up as. And what she found was that if you put in vaccine or vaccination in an American search engine, between 25 and 71% of the websites that came up on the first page were anti-vaccine websites. In Canada, we were a little bit better. It was around 20%, but very, very few people get past the first website. And so these loud voices, even though they're small in number, actually have created a debate on the internet. Interestingly, if you type in the word immunization in either the American or the Canadian web search engines, you actually get no anti-vaccine websites, because to immunize is actually a positive thing, because it's immunity, as opposed to vaccinate, where vaccine is a dirty word. Well, what are the results of this kind of insidious slide and anti-vaccine people shouting on the internet and convincing the vaccine hesitant not to do things? It leads actually to an insidious situation where lots of things that would not be acceptable become acceptable. And the most egregious example that I can think of is what just happened at University of Toronto, where a homeopath, a sessional instructor, Beth Lando Halpern, actually ran a course called Alternative Health, Practice and Theory. And it turned out that she was actually the wife of the dean of the Scarborough campus. Here is the excerpts from the course syllabus for the week when they were studying vaccines. The title was Vaccination King of Controversy. And here are some of the things that were required viewing. This course relied very heavily on web-based information, not so much on data or evidence. So interview with Andrew Wakefield, the discredited gastroenterologist from the UK who announced the MMR autism theory. Vaccine safety, a crime against humanity. Dissolving illusions, diseases, vaccines, and forgotten history. This was one of my favorite. Vaccination, social violence, and criminality. This was not a biased approach. And in fact, this was the final straw. Those of us who actually want to support vaccines in Canada, but who have been very hesitant to actually take a confrontational approach, finally got together under the leadership of Juliette Guichon at the University of Calgary. She's a lawyer. And she orchestrated a letter-writing campaign to the principal, the president, the board of University of Toronto, and orchestrated a series of meetings with U of T faculty, got them into the room with these senior people. And she's actually a spearhead of the formation of an activist group, the Canadian Alliance to Support Immunization. And when this group, of which I'm a signatory, sees something bad going on, as just happened yesterday when a bishop in a diocese in Edmonton decided to recommend strongly that the human papillomavirus vaccine not be given to girls because it would promote sexuality, Cassie actually wrote a letter directly to him and to his superiors and said, "What the hell are you doing?" Okay. We've not taken the gloves off very often. What is the outcome of this kind of activity on our part? Well, Beth Lando Halpern is no longer teaching at U of T. Rick Halpern has resigned. Unfortunately, Vivek Goel, who has actually charged with, he's the vice principal, a vice president for research and innovation, and really ironically, the ex-CEO of Public Health Ontario, he actually went in and whitewashed this course and said, basically, it's a senior year course, and these people should know how to read these things critically. So this is okay. It's okay to have a wildly biased curriculum because the students should know better. And the students didn't complain. Well, in fact, the students did complain. And the course, oh, he still has his job, by the way. The course, Alternative Health Practice and Theory, is actually gone. This is a success. I don't want to pick specifically on homeopathy, because it's actually too easy a target in some respects. But the fact is, again, this insidious environment where vaccines are suspect has allowed a number of other things to creep in. So, for example, many people don't know that there are things called nozodes that are homeopathic, naturopathic alternatives to vaccines. They're used in theory both for the treatment and the prevention of vaccine. And basically Health Canada and the Drugs and Health Products, the Natural Products Division, actually gives these things registration numbers. They are essentially licensed. And while drugs are required to be both safe and effective, nozodes are actually only required to be safe. They don't have to present any data that they're effective. And some of them that are registered in Canada are there for influenza, poliomyelitis, measles, and pertussis. There are about 80 nozodes that carry the stamp of Health Canada that they are at some level approved. This is ridiculous. So we have one hand of government in Canada saying that these are approved products for sale in Canada, and this has forced, under considerable pressure, the Minister of Health of Canada to actually say about these products that it is neither a vaccine nor an alternative to vaccination. It has not been proven to prevent infection. Health Canada does not recommend its use and advises your children to receive their vaccinations. This is incredible that one arm of government is saying one thing and another arm of government is basically saying don't use these registered products. Well, so I've been pointing a finger at other groups, and whenever you point a finger at another group, you should probably look in the mirror a little bit. What do anti-vaccine people see when they look at us, those who support vaccines? Well, one thing, this is part of my Canadian content, they see that we actually have very well-developed defensive reflexes. When anybody threatens vaccine programs, we round up and we fight back. Not very aggressively most of the time, but we do round up and we protect these programs. A huge sea change in the vaccine world is that the vaccine pharma component, used to be the cute little defender of good, right? Vaccines were the Zorros of the pharmaceutical industry. They didn't cost very much. They did wonderful things. Well, that's changed. Vaccines, in many cases, are now billion-dollar products. And that has resulted in a great deal of pressure, in some cases, to use vaccines. And it has made it a lot easier for anti-vaccine people to look at people who support vaccines and say, you're bought. Right? So 9 out of 10 doctors on our payroll recommend this product. And that's a very difficult situation to be in. So in 2015, we actually find ourselves in a situation where on the one side, the pro-vaccine community is looking at these other, at the anti-vaccine people and saying, you're kind of crazy. And on the other side, they're saying, you're a sellout. You're a shill. And there's pretty good evidence, actually, that as you polarize, people simply stop listening. And that's a real problem, because what we need to do is actually break this communication link here. We need to find better ways to communicate with these vaccine hesitant people. We will never convince these people. These people come to my office and try to convince me that vaccines are bad. But these people here are simply trying to do what's right. And so, in fact, that's where the middle ground is. On the pro and the con side, basically, we all love our kids and we do anything to protect them. And in fact, if there really was a conspiracy, people like Paul Offit and myself, we would probably know about it. And is it credible? Either that or we're really dumb. Is it credible that in fact I would put the health and safety of my 3 kids at risk in order to get another grant or in order to put a little money in my pocket? And that just is, to me, a completely illogical argument. So, there is a debate. One of the problems for us on that pro-vaccine side is that some debates never go away. We have to keep fighting the same battles. Andrew Wakefield, who promoted the MMR vaccine autism theory, was thoroughly debunked. He lost his job. They lost their major court cases. I believe now he is giving lectures on cruise ships. But the fact is, for many people, he's still a hero. This was taken off of Natural News just last night. Look at what this said. The controversial autism vaccine researcher was found dead from a suspicious gunshot wound. This is, unfortunately, Jeff Bradstreet, who was one of the main proponents of the vaccine MMR autism theory. Right? Conspiracy. Vaccines and autism. Epidemic accelerates. MMR study promoting vaccines funded by Big Pharma. It's all the same themes coming back. But the reason I'm showing you this is that Joe Schwartz is probably going to say some very nice things about Paul Offit. And in fact, he featured quite prominently on this website, Paul Offit's Vaccine Lies Deconstructed, a mind-blowing interview. So I thought I would just excerpt something to add to Paul's introduction. He is an internationally renowned expert, it seems, on just about everything, including all forms of religion. But basically, he is Big Pharma's pit bull in a white coat and the media's sweetheart pro-vaccinator. So add that to whatever Joe is going to say about him. And actually, probably all of you will be able to think about when he comes up here to talk is the fact that friendly pit bulls in a fight, if they're on your side, are not necessarily a bad thing. And don't underestimate this. This is a fight, and it's going to be a fight for a very long time, south of the border, north of the border. Thank you for your attention.
Well, Paul, I can't outdo that introduction. That's about as good as it gets. Before we get to Paul, though, follow up on the UFT homeopathy thing, not that we're into bashing UFT, unless they deserve it, which in this case they do, is that Landau Halpern, the homeopath who lost her job there, is also involved in a study with the dean of pharmacy at UFT, Heather Boone, to investigate a homeopathic solution for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So they are actually mounting a study on ADHD at the UFT on homeopathy and ADHD. It's really quite mind-boggling. But the mind boggles further when we found out yesterday that Dr. Boone was the recipient of a $250,000 prize, the Rogers Prize, which is awarded every 2 years in Canada for advances in alternative medicine. It's hard to know what to say about that. Anyway, Brian introduced Paul extremely well. What else can I tell you except that he's a diehard Philadelphia Eagles fan? And that's not an easy thing to deal with. The fact that he gets threatened by the anti-vaccine people is nothing compared to the sorrows that the Eagles have provided. Seriously speaking, Paul has written a number of books, not only on vaccination, also on alternative medicine. He's a great champion of critical thinking, and he has a wonderful voice, as you will experience, in explaining science. So it's not only the content, but it's also the style that you will appreciate. So, Paul.
Well, that was a first. First of all, thanks to the Trottiers for their support of not just the symposium, but of trying to educate the public about science in general. It's a noble thing to do, and few do it. So this year in our country, as Brian alluded to, we have a measles outbreak that started in Southern California associated with Disneyland, and then it has spread actually to 25 states involving about 158 people, and has spread into Canada because measles doesn't recognize international borders, so there have been outbreaks in British Columbia, outbreaks in Quebec. And the reason that that's happened is that people have chosen not to vaccinate their children, and the reason that they've made that choice is that they're not scared of the disease. But I'm scared of the disease because I lived through the 1991 Philadelphia measles epidemic, an epidemic like no other, and I'd like you to live through it too. So it started on April 20th, 1989, when, after returning from a trip to Spain, a teenager with a blotchy rash attends an REM concert at the Spectrum in Philadelphia. A couple weeks later, several other teenagers get sick. Measles virus has now entered our city. On May 21st, 1990, this headline appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer, the comical title of which suggests that measles is really no big deal. But measles is a big deal because before the vaccine was first introduced in the United States in 1963, every year the virus caused about 3 million cases, roughly 48,000 hospitalizations and 500 deaths. Almost everyone was infected by 15 years of age. Deaths were caused typically by pneumonia, encephalitis, which is just inflammation of the brain, and dehydration. Now, the vaccine worked. By 1978, only 27,000 cases of measles were reported, and the CDC was optimistic that measles could be eliminated from the U.S. and launched the Measles Elimination Program with the goal to eliminate the disease by 1982. In 1983, there were only 1,500 cases reported. By the way, we actually did officially eliminate measles from our country in 2000, but it's come back recently because people have chosen not to vaccinate their children. But in any case, in 1989, measles did come back. Now, in our city, by November 29, 1990, there were 96 Philadelphia children infected with measles. By December 7th, that number increased to 124. By December 31st, that number increased to 258. And in December of 1990, an 18-month-old boy died from measles pneumonia. That was the first death in our city in 20 years from measles. On June 12, 1990, this headline appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer as another child died. Both measles deaths occurred in unimmunized children, and the Philadelphia Health Commissioner, who was Bob Ross, recommends now that the first dose be given instead of between 12 and 15 months of age, be moved down to 6 months of age. 7 weeks later, city health officials will do something that has never been done before in our country, or yours, and has never been done since. This is a picture of Dr. Robert Ross. I guess you can't see the bottom of these slides, but in any case, on January 16, 1991, Bob receives an anonymous phone call from a woman whose daughter belongs to the Faith Tabernacle Church in North Philadelphia. The woman warns Ross that church members don't believe in medical care. No one has died yet, says Ross, but for the first time, we worried that we might not hear about a case of measles until a church member calls the police or calls a coroner. Now, the Faith Tabernacle Church's doctrine instructs members to believe that the Bible is opposed to all means of healing apart from God's way. If I go to church and ask them to heal my body, says church member Gordon Korn, I can't go to a doctor for medicine. You either trust God or you trust man. The church school contains hundreds of children, none of whom are immunized. This is actually a picture of the Faith Tabernacle Church, which actually was taken just recently. It's still active in North Philadelphia. Now, on February 11, 1991, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer as two more children die. On February 7th, a few days earlier, Karen Still, a 9-year-old girl, is pronounced dead from measles. On February 10th, Monica Johnson, a classmate, is also pronounced dead. Monica is one of 11 children in the home, all of whom are unimmunized. Monica's father is a teacher at the Faith Tabernacle Schools and says, quote, I feel very confident in my belief in the way I've raised my children. Monica is something that God has given us and now has taken away. After Karen Still's death, Bob Ross meets with Reverend Charles Reinert, who is the pastor of the Faith Tabernacle Church. Quote, he was soft-spoken, the consummate gentleman, says Ross, but he drove us nuts. We told him we needed to vaccinate everyone in the school, but he said the families wouldn't let us do it. On February 12, 1991, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer as the courts in Philadelphia take the first of what are to be 4 legal steps trying to deal with this burgeoning epidemic. Ross now obtains a court order to visit the families who refuse to let him touch their children. What he's allowed to do is he's allowed to walk into the home. He's allowed to walk to the door frame of where the child's room is, but he is not allowed to walk into the room. He has to look at the child to see whether there's any clear evidence for dehydration or shock or pneumonia. Quote, most of the families had 6, 8, 10, 12 kids because they didn't believe in birth control, says Ross. There were also a lot of kids who were physically or mentally disabled because they all had in-house deliveries. Even if the kids were born breech, they didn't do a C-section. It was like the old days. So Ross finds that the kids appear well. Quote, these kids had the rash. They were lying in bed, but they were alert, conversant, and appeared well hydrated. He pleads with the parents to let him know if these children get any sicker. He's trusting the parents to let him know if they get worse. when February 15th, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer as another child dies. Remember, just to put this in perspective, the current measles epidemic in the United States, which got a tremendous amount of media attention, has caused several states to now withdraw their philosophical or conscientious objection to vaccination, has involved 158 children and no deaths. This is one city over a three-month period, 1991, 30 years into the development of a measles vaccine. On February 14th, the police are called to the home of Lynette Milnes, who is pronounced dead. Milnes doesn't attend the Faith Tabernacle Church, but her sister does. Lynette's seven brothers and sisters are all unimmunized. Quote, when another kid turned up at the morgue, I checked my list and realized she was on it, said Ross. I had just called the mother, and she told me her kids were fine. So, Ross refers the case to District Attorney Ron Castile, who considers filing criminal charges but demurs. Quote, unfortunately, when the parent is willing to risk the death of their children because of religious belief, says Castile, it's unlikely that the threat of prosecution will in any way act as a deterrent. That's actually not true. I mean, if you look at, there are 44 states in the United States that have religious exemptions to child abuse and neglect laws, including medical neglect. There's a reason for that, which we can talk about later if you want, but recently Oregon overturned that law because they have a group called the Followers of Christ Church, which also not only don't believe in vaccines, but don't believe in medical care, and when they overturned that law, those parents took their children to the doctors because they didn't want to go to jail, because they didn't want their children to go to foster care. So it is possible that the law does change things. That was an election year, though, and I think Ron Castile didn't want to take on the issue of religion. So the Philadelphia courts now take step two. Ross realizes that the information he's getting from parents is inaccurate, so he gets a court order to physically examine children. Now he can touch them legally. He enlists the residents at our hospital, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and St. Christopher's Hospital to go door to door. Quote, it was one of the more inspiring moments in my 30 years in healthcare, says Ross. These are very busy people on call every third night, yet they were happy to do it. But on February 15, 1991, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Daily News as two more children die. In the early morning of February 15th, Nancy Evans, a five-year-old from North Central Philadelphia, dies from measles. Nancy doesn't belong to the Faith Tabernacle Church. Rather, she belongs to the First Century Gospel Church, another faith-healing church in our city. Also on February 15th, Tina Louise Johnson, the 13-year-old sister of Monica Johnson, dies on the day of Monica's funeral. Neither Nancy Evans nor Tina Louise Johnson were taken to a doctor when their illnesses worsened. So, five children have now died in a 10-day period. Philadelphia is in the midst of the single worst measles epidemic in the United States in the vaccine era. Typically in the U.S., about 1 in 1,000 infected children will die from measles. In some developing world countries, that number can reach as high as 1 in 300. But in Philadelphia in 1991, 4 of 150 children with measles who attend the Faith Tabernacle Church are dead. That is a mortality rate of 1 in 35, worse than in any developing world nation. For this reason, on February 15, 1991, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, located in Atlanta, sends a team to investigate. The question they were trying to answer is, what was going on in Philadelphia? Was it that the circulating strain in our city was more virulent than that those strains circulating in other cities? Bill Atkinson headed that team, and what he found was that measles deaths had nothing to do with the circulating strain and everything to do with the parents. Children were dying because they weren't getting intravenous fluids for their severe dehydration or oxygen for their pneumonia. Late in February 1991, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It's children stricken with measles. Church puts faith in God's healing. For the first time now, under pressure, Charles Reinert, the pastor of the Faith Tabernacle Church, speaks out. The devil has tried to put fear in people's hearts, says Reinert. Job was robbed of everything he had. As he went through the trial, he learned from it. There is no fear when you see God on your side. Reinert sees deaths in his church as a test of his faith, a test he has every intention of passing. It's drawing us all together, he says. Now Ross and the courts in Philadelphia take the third step. Ross asks the mayor to obtain a court order to hospitalize children against their parents' will. With the telephone number of a judge in hand, the residents examined children from the Faith Tabernacle Church. Quote, it was like entering a time warp, said Mark Jaffe, who headed the St. Chris's team. With the exception of the fact that they stay at home and watch their children die from measles, they seem like wonderful people. On February 18th, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer: "As we are successfully able to hospitalize children against their parents' will." The first is Daniel Kern, a 4-year-old who develops measles pneumonia. The healthcare worker insists on admitting the child to the hospital. The parents politely but firmly refuse. Ross calls city solicitor Charisse Lilly, who calls family court judge Edward Summers, who gets an emergency order to hospitalize the boy. A second child, 1-year-old Bianca Carpina, is also hospitalized against her parents' will. So, the Philadelphia measles epidemic is now at its peak. At our hospital, about 82 children have been seen in the emergency department and 28 have been hospitalized. When the dust settled, those numbers were closer to 240. At St. Christopher's Hospital, 250 children are seen in the emergency department and 3 are being hospitalized every week. Ross and his team have visited 80 families and 500 children, but predicts correctly that there will be more measles deaths in the city of Philadelphia. On February 21st, 1991, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Daily News: "Philadelphia is now a feared destination. 2 nearby schools cancel trips to the city. The city prints 50,000 educational pamphlets and is vaccinating hundreds of school children every week. Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, sends $100,000 in federal funds to help." And then on February 27, 1991, Mayor Wilson Good asked the city solicitor's office to obtain a court order to forcibly vaccinate children against their parents' will. So let's take a step back. According to the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution, states are permitted to compel vaccination of their citizens. The key case here was a case in 1905 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just near Boston, the so-called Jacobson v. Massachusetts case. There was an outbreak of smallpox in Cambridge. Henning Jacobson was a Lutheran minister who believed that God would protect him for his faithfulness. He refused to get a vaccine, and he refused to pay the $5 fine. That case worked its way from a local court to a state Supreme Court to the United States Supreme Court, where, writing for the majority, Justice John Marshall Harlan said, and this, oh, there it is, quote, "The liberty secured by the Constitution of the United States does not import an absolute right to be wholly freed from restraint. There are manifold restraints to which every person is necessarily subject for the common good. Society is based on the rule that each one is a law unto, I'm so sorry, society based on the rule that each one is a law unto himself would soon be confronted with anarchy and disorder." This went to the United States Supreme Court one more time. It was the case of Zucht v. King. Rosalind Zucht was expelled from a Brackenridge High School in San Antonio, Texas, because she refused a smallpox vaccine. The difference between this case and the past one is there was no smallpox epidemic in San Antonio at the time. In either case, the Supreme Court, now 17 years later, supported the previous decision in Zucht v. King, in Jacobson v. Massachusetts. There's one more case, and it's not a vaccine case, although the ruling did include a paragraph about vaccines, so I just want to briefly touch on it because it is probably the single most cited public health case that has ever gone before the United States Supreme Court. It involved a woman named Sarah Prince, who was a Jehovah's Witness. She wanted to take her niece as well as her son to distribute pamphlets supporting Jehovah's Witness thoughts on the streets of Brockton, Massachusetts at night. That violated child labor laws. You can't take a girl who's less than 18 years of age and have her distribute pamphlets at night. That's considered to be a violation of her safety. Sarah Prince believed that this was her right, her religious freedom based on the First Amendment to the Constitution. So that's what this really was. It was really a child labor law versus religious freedom case. But that said, this was written in the ruling. Quote, "A parent cannot claim freedom from compulsory vaccination for the child any more than for himself on religious grounds. The right to practice religion freely does not include the liberty to expose the community to infectious disease. Parents may be free to become martyrs themselves, but it does not follow that they are free to make martyrs of their children." Now, although there's no constitutional right to refuse vaccines, states may allow exemptions. Now, originally, there's a number of state Supreme Court verdicts that were all in favor of the state's right to compel vaccination. In each case, the parents argued, it's my religious right to choose not to be vaccinated. In each case, the ruling was against them, basically claiming that you're not being discriminated against on the basis of your religion, because all religions are being asked to be vaccinated. Now, a door opened in 1966 in the New York State Assembly, once again showing that bad things come from New York. I mean, take your pick. The Giants, personally, to me, the New York Giants, or the Mets, the Yankees certainly are. So, in any case, New York State was considering a bill requiring polio vaccine for school entry, a bill that passed by a vote of 150-2. But there were two dissenting votes because the bill excluded parents whose religion forbade vaccination. Now, this is a direct result of the lobbying efforts of one particular religious group. So I'll ask you, what religious group was that? I'll give you a hint. This is a group whose the major text of its religion states that you should not be vaccinated. Now, remember, the first vaccine was in 1796. That was the smallpox vaccine. The Old Testament was written between 1400 and 400 BC, never mentions vaccines. The New Testament around 100 AD plus, never mentions vaccines. The Quran around 600 AD never mentions or predicts the existence of vaccines. So this would have had to have been a religious group that was founded after 1796. Can you name that religious group? You know, it's fun. That's what everybody says the first. They always say Mormons. No, it's not. It's not Mormons, actually, although that is a religious group founded after 1796. But Scientology, interesting. How that is a religious group is beyond me, but it's not. But you're close. It's not exactly Scientology. It's Christian Science. So Christian Science was founded in 1875 by Mary Baker Eddy with her book, Science and Health with the Key to the Scriptures. She believed that illness was a spiritual, not a physical disorder, that diseases should be treated with prayer, not medicines or surgeries. Quote, we have smallpox because others have it, but mortal mind, not matter, contains and carries the infection. This is 1875. This is still before Freud. So it's not so much psychosomatic illness that she's talking about. She didn't really believe in mind over matter as much of that she didn't believe in matter. In other words, that if you saw a boil on the back of your hand, it can't be there because God is perfect, because God creates man in his image, therefore man is perfect, so that boil isn't there. If you get closer to God through prayer or supplication, the boil will go away because it's not there. So that's really where she was coming from. And frankly, at the time she put forth her book, it was very popular. Christian Science was the most popular religion in our country in the late 1800s. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of Christian scientists. There were Christian Science reading rooms that sprung up in every city in our country because she had something to offer. Medicine didn't have much to offer in 1875. I mean, what did we really have? We had, you know, quinine for malaria. We had ether and chloroform for anesthesia. We still didn't have anti-seizure medicines. We didn't have antibiotics, and that's all in the early 1900s. So we didn't have much to offer. So, you know, what she did was she put the power to heal in the hands of the people. Through prayer, you could heal. And, you know, the aphorism at the time was that, new doctors, that old doctors sort of let you die, and the older doctors and younger doctors, you know, do things to kill you, you know, leeches, you know, cauterization. So I think that's what she had to offer. The GNC Center does that today, by the way. I don't know if you have that here, but, you know, it's where you walk in and you get your dietary supplements. It's sort of like a modern-day thing for taking control of your own health. Just kidding. Okay, so that opened a door. What happened in New York in 1966 opened a door, and the famous case was Mayor V. Besser, where basically took advantage of that law saying, you know, you're discriminating against me because I'm not a Christian Scientist. There's a law in the books that says if I'm a Christian Scientist, I don't have to get vaccinated, and this opened the door for basically religious exemptions, which now exists in 47 states. The line between religion and philosophy is a blurry one, and that then opened the door now for philosophical exemptions. Lou Levy claiming to us religion is not a temple, religion is not something outside of our bodies. And so if you had a conviction that was with the strength of a religious conviction, then you didn't have to be vaccinated. So on February 28th, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Now I'll say this, a couple things. One is there's a difference, a legal difference between a mandatory vaccination and a compulsory vaccination. A mandatory vaccination is you are asked to get a vaccine. If you don't get a vaccine, then you will pay some sort of societal price. In the case of Henning Jacobson, a $5 fine. In the case of Rosalind Zuck, you don't get to go to the school you want to go to. Today, you may not be able to, if you don't get an influenza vaccine at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, you can't work there as a healthcare worker. So you may not be able to work at the hospital you want to work at. A compulsory vaccination is you are vaccinated whether or not you want to be or not. Well, I should say more. First of all, no child wants to be vaccinated. You were vaccinated whether or not your parent wants you to be vaccinated or not. That's probably a little more accurate. In any case, on February 28, 1991, the city sought a court order to basically force these parents to vaccinate their children against their will. Now there had been a religious exemption to vaccination on the books in our state for 10 years. So what the parents were doing was perfectly within their legal right to do that. So what the parents did was they sought out the American Civil Liberties Union to defend them. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with the ACLU, but the American Civil Liberties Union is perfectly willing to take on unpopular causes, both before and since. Since, for example, in Florida in 2009, they represented the Dove World Outreach Center when they wanted their children to wear these shirts, "Islam is of the devil," to a school which also included Muslims. They won that case. They won the case of the Westboro Baptist Church, which is a group that believes that homosexuality is a sin, that America is being punished for that sin by having soldiers die in wars, and so they then protest at funerals of Americans who died in war with signs like that, including the T-shirt this girl is wearing represents the URL of their website, GodHatesFags.com. And probably most famously, they represented successfully the desire of neo-Nazis to march down the streets of Skokie, Illinois in 1977. Skokie is a suburb of Chicago. It was home in 1977, is home to many Jews, and in 1977 to many Jews who had been Holocaust survivors. This actually prompted the online humor magazine The Onion to come up with the title, ACLU Defends Neo-Nazis' Right to Burn Down ACLU Headquarters. So, on March 2nd, 1991, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer. As I can tell you, every single person who was living in that city was stunned to find out that the ACLU declined to help the parents in this case. There is certainly a free exercise of religion claim by the parents, said Deborah Levy of the Philadelphia chapter of the ACLU, but there is also a competing claim that parents don't have the right to martyr their children, this thus sounding that sort of previous ruling from Prince v. Massachusetts. I don't think we've walked away from our principles here. On March 2nd, the judge permits the city to vaccinate objectives. Jerome Balter, who was a lawyer for the parents of Faith Tabernacle, protested Summers' decisions. The parents had their lawyer. The children had a separate lawyer. Their healing is dependent on their faith, he says. They believe that's the right thing for their children. The judge rules in favor of the city. It ultimately goes to the Pennsylvania State Superior Court of Appeals, where Vincent Cirillo heard that appeal. The woman who was representing, the lawyer who was representing the children during that hearing had a pained look on her face after she had been given a note. "Are you ill?" asked Cirillo. Lacey had just been handed a note concerning a 20-month-old boy, James Jones, whose parents were members of the Faith Tabernacle Church and who had just died of measles encephalitis. Balter now argues that parents are willing to allow their sick children to be admitted to the hospital, but they still refuse to be vaccinated, implying that treatment is as good as prevention, certainly something that had been contradicted by previous events. And then on March 9th, children got vaccinated against their parents' will well after this epidemic had already significantly slowed down. "Typically, measles is a disease of the late winter and early spring," says Levinson, director of disease control. "When the warm weather comes, the cases disappear. Charles Reinert, who is the pastor of the Faith Tabernacle Church, has a different interpretation, focusing on the children in his church who would survive the infection without medical care. He said, we believe God has provided his faithfulness." In 1992, the group that had come down from up from the CDC to investigate reported what they found in the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal. Among church members, 486 people were infected and 6 died. Among non-church members, as the virus spread to the surrounding community, 938 people were infected and 3 died. All 9 deaths were in children. The attack rate in children in church members was about 1,000-fold greater than the general community. In 2013, the CDC identifies about 30,000 children whose parents have chosen not to vaccinate them for religious reasons. Given the underreporting and the insular nature of some of these faith healing groups, I think that number is probably a lot larger. Okay, I'm going to regret this slide, but I'm going to do it anyway. And the fact of the matter is I'm getting on a plane flying back to the United States tomorrow, so I'm probably good. But just for young people here, you should never, ever talk about religion in public. It's a loser, but I'm going to do it anyway. When I was in Well, I'll take a step back. I wrote a book about this that includes this as a chapter. The book is called Bad Faith, When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. And when I wrote that book, when I started to write that book, my feeling, and I'm not a religious person, just full disclosure, but my feeling was that I was going to take this sort of Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, religion is illogical and potentially harmful approach. But I didn't. And the reason I didn't was because of sort of my experience being in the hospital at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia during this outbreak. Because I got a chance, once these parents were forced basically to come into our hospital, to talk to a lot of these parents. And they always had the same answer. When asked the question, why did you let this happen, your child get so sick without medical care, they would always say, well, we were treating our children. We were praying. Jesus was our doctor. So I thought, in fairness, what I would do is I would read the New Testament. So I read the New Testament and came to this conclusion. Again, never talk about religion in public. Independent of whether you believe that a supreme being exists, and independent of whether you believe that Jesus was the Son of God, and independent of whether you believe that the Gospels, which were written, you know, starting about 30 years, Mark was written about 30 years after Jesus' death, are in any way an accurate reflection of what he did or what he said, you have to be impressed with the figure described as Jesus of Nazareth, because he was a breakthrough figure. I mean, at the time of his life, which was roughly 4 BC to 30 AD, child abuse was the crying vice of the Roman Empire. I mean, abandonment was common, infanticide was common, children were property. I mean, they were treated no differently than slaves. I mean, it really wasn't until Constantine in 315 AD, who was the first Christian emperor of Rome, that you saw any sort of laws protecting children from abuse. And then in 321 AD from being indigent. You know, Jesus stood up for children. I mean, there's a statement after statement in the New Testament of him standing up for children. Suffer me the children, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Or my favorite line actually was from Matthew 25:40. Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of my brethren, you have done it unto me. I mean, you could take that and emblazon that onto the entranceway of every children's hospital in the world. So I don't get it. I mean, I don't get this. And I don't. What upsets me the most about this is a choice to put your child in harm's way is a profoundly unreligious act. I think if anything, religion teaches us to care about our children, to protect them, to care about community, to care about family. So, you know, when we talk about religion, in this setting, we just always stand back. No one wants to touch it. And what really upset me during this whole epidemic, as upsetting as this all was, as we were watching child after child being pulled out of a house dead, was where the hell was the church? I mean, it would have been nice for somebody to stand up and say, this isn't us. I guess this is all from the fact the Pope was just in our city the last few days. Maybe that's where this is all coming from. But, you know, it would have helped. It wouldn't have changed the minds of Faith Tabernacle or First Century Gospel, but it certainly would have helped the public health and legal community as we were trying to move forward largely on our own. So I will then close with this thought. Why do we allow such a profoundly unreligious act to be performed in the name of religion? I gave this talk once in New Orleans. Somebody sent me a thing, which I'll show you in a second, that was sitting in front of a church. So I'll end with just this slide. Thanks.
Okay, you can address questions either to Brian or to Paul about what they spoke about, or about any aspect of vaccination or immunology. And if you would just walk over to one of the mics that are set up.
Yes, I'm Helen Strobach. My question is for Dr. Ward. I was quite impressed with the first diagram you showed us, where there's a slow but constant decline in the belief of vaccines among the medical groups as well as scientists. And I would have thought these were the groups where there was higher level of education, training about critical thinking. And I'm wondering then, how would you explain this decline in the thinking of these two groups. What is it that we are doing wrong that they don't believe in the evidence that has been put forward?
Well, so one of the things that's very impressive is that if I go out and I give a talk in a nursing home, for example, or a talk where there are more gray hairs in the audience, most of the people who are over 55, 60, very few of them vote, raise their hands under 8. So you're talking about an average of 9. So there's a clear age-related effect. And I think that the young people at McGill are just responding to the general mood that they hear newspaper articles about vaccine problems. They hear claims being made against vaccines. There's controversy, so it can't be a 10 or even a 9. And so there's just been this slow loss of confidence. It's like a water torture, just a drip, drip, drip of bad news and very little good news. Most of the media are not covering things like, you know, most children still protected from. They're much happier to talk about controversies around vaccines. And I think that is just it's a wearing process. It's an irritant. And so the students just bring their votes down.
You know, I'll just add this. You didn't have to convince my parents, as Brian said. You didn't have to convince my parents to get vaccinated. They saw, you know, diphtheria as a common killer of teenagers. They saw polio as a common cause of paralysis. You didn't have to convince me to vaccinate my children. I mean, I'm a child of the 50s and 60s. I had measles. I had mumps. I had rubella. I had varicella. I had all those diseases. But my children, who were 23 and 20, not only don't see these diseases, they didn't grow up with these diseases. And so for them, vaccination is a matter of faith. I mean, faith in whom? Faith in the pharmaceutical industry, the medical establishment, the government, and there's an absence, at least in that kind of faith. People are compelled by fear more than reason. And if you don't see the diseases, then you don't fear them. The reason that we have had such an excellent response now to vaccination, I mean, people in Southern California now are getting vaccinated. Why? Because they fear measles. It's too bad it has to come to that. You would argue in a more reasonable world we would learn from history, and that if you lower immunization rates, these diseases obviously are going to come back. But I guess this is the only way we're going to learn it, is to have to watch these diseases come back. It's sad.
I think you were asking how educated people can believe in essentially wrong things, but there are numerous examples of that. I mean, we have physicians who are also homeopaths. I mean, how do you explain that?
You want me to take a guess? I think it's because people like to be liked. And physicians too, and you know, and there's a certain power in being able to say, "I'm going to make you better. I'm going to make you better," and to know that there is a group of people who are going to buy into that sort of magic. It's seductive, you know, even though it obviously is scientifically nonsense.
Lauren, do you have a question?
I'm just curious whether, with the outbreak that happened in Disneyland last year, mentioning that in California some regulations are coming in, has there been any indication that public opinion and attitudes towards vaccinations has moved as a result of that incident?
Most definitely. That measles. It's interesting. If you look the year before last, in 2014, there was a measles outbreak that involved, in the U.S., about 680 people. That's 3 times the current outbreak. Got no media attention. Why? Because it involved primarily a group of Amish folks in Medina County, Ohio. So people saw that as insular, other, not us. This time, Disneyland is seen as a commons, as a shared space. I mean, my children can go to Disneyland, therefore it matters. And so everybody got up in arms. I have never seen anything like it. People are really angry for the first time at those parents who are choosing not to vaccinate their children, putting not only their children at risk, but others at risk. And the reason that California is not the state you would pick to overturn a philosophical exemption. They become only the third state in the United States to have only medical exemptions. But the way that it happened, and they sort of fell into it, was their poster child was a 3-year-old girl with leukemia. And the statement was, what about her? She can't be vaccinated. She depends on the herd. She depends on your vaccinating your child to keep her from getting sick. And, you know, when I was in high school, there was a boy in my high school class. Now, I remember it well. His name was Billy Lynn. He had leukemia. And he was diagnosed in the ninth grade. This was the time before we were very good about treating leukemia. He died by the time we were in the 12th grade. I can't imagine any of our parents sending us into that room unvaccinated, knowing that he was there. Maybe it's just a different time. It's a more selfish time. But, you know, how about them? You know, in our country, there's 314 million people. 500,000 can't be vaccinated because they're getting cancer for their chemotherapy or because they're getting immune suppressive therapy for their chronic disease or because they're too young. How about them? Do we have any responsibility to them? Because when you make a choice not to vaccinate yourself, you're making a choice for others. And I think that's why that California campaign was so successful. But it was so successful because measles was knocking at the door.
There was a very similar event with the H1N1 in 2009-2010. There was considerable resistance to the universal vaccination program. And then two teenagers died in Ontario. And suddenly there was a shortage of vaccine. People were lining up and crying that there wasn't enough vaccine. And that happened over the space of about a week.
Also on the question of regulation and government rules regarding vaccination, what are your views on that? Should childhood vaccination be compulsory, or should there be some measures that strongly kind of get parents to get their kids vaccinated?
You know, in a better world, they wouldn't need to be mandated, right, or made compulsory. In a better world, people would know the data. They would know that vaccines' benefits outweigh their risks. They would get vaccinated. Scandinavian countries don't have mandated vaccines. They have vaccination rates in the high 90% range. Same with Hungary, high 90% range. They don't have mandated vaccines. I can tell you in the United States, a country founded on individual rights and freedoms, if we did that, if we made vaccines optional, immunization rates would be far worse and children would suffer more. So... So I think, sadly, we need mandatory. You know, the reason that we had compulsory vaccination in Philadelphia was because it was that bad. I mean, it got that bad. Is that where it has to, do we have to get to that point, really, before we talk about compulsory vaccination? I mean, is it the question is this. Is it your right? Just watching the Republican... The Republican national debates, I don't know if any of you watch this. I don't recommend it. It's big television.
I think you have to hold it closer. I think that's the thing.
Is that better?
Right. No?
Say it again. Turn this off.
The electrical engineer there, mate.
Let's see the one. How about if I just scream? Would that work? I mean, through the Republican national debates, Rand Paul says, can you hear me now? Now?
That's on.
How about now?
Yes.
Okay. Rand Paul said, the government doesn't, because this is a very big Republican theme, the theme of freedom of choice, the government doesn't own your children, you own your children. That's not true. You don't own your children. You own your car. You don't own your child. When you have your child, you have a responsibility, and that responsibility includes putting them in the safest position possible. Is it your right as a parent to allow your child to catch and transmit a potentially fatal disease? I think the answer to that question is no.
He says you have to be close about that far.
So I don't think this. Let me put it this way: Chris, just to continue to pick on the Republicans. Okay, I'm a Democrat. Shoot me. But the Chris Christie, interestingly, said the same thing. He said that this is a parent's choice. Interestingly, Chris Christie lives in a state that has a child seat law. If you choose not to put your child of a certain age and weight in a car seat, you get a ticket. Click it or ticket. That's the name of the program. There's no religious exemption to car seats. There's no philosophical exemption to car seats. Why? Because car seats save lives. Vaccines are no different. So I think it shouldn't be your choice not to vaccinate a child, assuming they don't have a medical contraindication, because it puts your child at unnecessary risk and others around them at unnecessary risk. And this is why I get the hate mail that I get, and that the anti-vaccine people hate me. So, but I don't think I'm a pit bull. Do you think I'm a pit bull? I think that was wrong.
Yeah.
I'm a bit confused. I have three marks on my right arm. They're my vaccinations I received in the 1930s. I got them in Europe. I came to Canada before the war. And nothing happened. I was living in the North Country. We didn't have all these fancy doctors up there and hospitals. And when I came to McGill in the 50s, I was in biology class. That was an elective. I was in engineering. My legs suddenly, I couldn't walk. Those nerves were cut off or something. Anyways, I got home and I called Dr. LaCharité. He was a mayor of Villa Salle. And I said, he said, have you had your polio shot yet? And I says, I don't know. I guess I didn't because I didn't have any shots. And I had a polio shot somewhere along the way. I didn't have polio, thank God. But I got a little concerned and wanted to know what vaccinations were all about. But I was lucky, I guess. I could have got polio. I haven't done anything since. I'm in my late 70s. And what's the big deal? I mean, I'm still around. Is my immune system different from somebody else or what?
Yeah. So let me tell you who's not coming up to this microphone right now. The people who are not coming up from this mic to the microphone now are the people who didn't get vaccinated because either they were born too early for those vaccines or because they chose not to vaccinate themselves or their children, who died from those diseases. That's who's not coming. It's always the survivors that tell the story, right? I mean, it's like I smoked for, you know, two packs of cigarettes a day for 50 years and I'm fine. I'm glad that you have survived into your 70s and were at 70 and didn't get the vaccines other than what sounds like maybe the smallpox vaccine, but you were lucky. I mean, not everybody was so lucky. But do I think that it's because of something unique to your immune system? No, I think you were just lucky.
So immunity, the goodness or badness of immunity has nothing to do with it?
There's no such thing. Well, let me put it this way. There's only two ways to get specific immunity. If you want specific immunity to polio or diphtheria or measles or mumps, there's two ways to get it. You can be vaccinated or you can be naturally infected. Being healthy, for example, and making sure you eat all the right foods, that's great, but that doesn't provide specific immunity.
Thank you.
I think it's important to say that the large majority of people, even in the absence of any vaccines, survive. So the vaccines are not necessary for the future of the human race, but the risks that you take if you're not vaccinated are still very large. They're unacceptably large for most people.
Don't get me wrong. My children and all my grandchildren are vaccinated totally. Thank you.
Right. I guess a year ago, there was a still slightly raging Ebola epidemic in a few African countries. Has that skewed the anti-vaccines, or because they've seen the horror that can happen when a horrible disease like Ebola starts spreading like wildfire? Has it done anything to this debate?
Brian may feel differently. I don't think it did anything to the debate in North America. At least certainly that wasn't my impression in the United States, because it's seen as, for the same reason I think that the Amish outbreak did not, of measles, which...
Get closer.
People keep telling me to get closer. There you go. Okay, so I don't think it did anything here. Maybe it's just me.
Yep.
Is that it? You think it's because the Pope was just in Philadelphia? You think that could be it?
You have an aura.
So do you feel different?
I don't think it had much of an impact. I think one of the largest problems with the Ebola vaccine effort was how to conduct vaccine trials in an ethical way in the environment of a rampaging epidemic. That actually was a major learning episode for the world, because we're challenged to figure out ways to introduce vaccines and treatments in a way that satisfied science, but also allowed us to get reliable data, which was a challenge in those environments. A number of us in the audience, Stefan Pillet and myself, we've been involved in some of these discussions and designing those studies. Not easy.
Over the years, as somebody who's been interested in communicating science at the public interface, I found myself talking about vaccines, and have always been very excited to help diffuse the argument through the Wakefields and through the thimerosal and moving forward. It seems that the goalpost has moved and now has stuck at the vaccine schedule. And what is the best argument from a physician standpoint as to how the current number of vaccines over a concentrated time does or does not contribute to other disorders or potential disease?
Okay, here's what I would say. 100 years ago, we got one vaccine, the smallpox vaccine. Today, in the United States, God, it's just me, I guess, isn't it? It's just today in the United States.
Paul, you want to come here and talk from here?
If it happens again here, I quit. All right, good. So today,
Paul, maybe you're right. Even get religious comments doesn't work.
I know. So today in the United States, children in the first few years of life get 14 different vaccines, or vaccines that prevent 14 different diseases. And so the number 14 is greater than the number 1, and it also means children, at least in the U.S., can get as many as 26 inoculations in the first few years of life. They can get as many as 5 shots at one time. But, you know, using biological fluids most people don't understand to prevent diseases most people don't see. So it's not surprising that there's a pushback to vaccines. But it's not the number of vaccines that matter. It's the number of immunological components in vaccines. And by immunological component, I mean bacterial protein, bacterial polysaccharide, viral protein. If you add up the number of immunological components in the one vaccine that we got 100 years ago, the smallpox vaccine, it's about 200. And that doesn't count, because it's the largest of the mammalian viruses. That doesn't count all the lymph proteins that were used in that vaccine, given the way that it was made. If you add up all the vaccine components in today's vaccines, because we've had advances in protein purification and recombinant DNA technology, it's about 150. So we actually get a lesser immunological challenge, one. Two is, when you're in the womb, you're in a sterile environment. When you enter the birth canal in the world, you're not. And very quickly, you have living on the surface of your body trillions of bacteria. I'm not just trying to sound like Carl Sagan. Literally, trillions of bacteria. You have about 10 to the 14th bacteria on the surface of your body. That's 100 trillion bacteria. That's more than you have cells in your body. You have about 10 trillion cells in your body. You have 10 times more bacteria on the surface of your body than you have cells in your body, to which you make an immune response. An adult human will make grams of secretory immunoglobulin every day and grams of immunoglobulin G every day to make sure that those bacteria stay at the surface and don't invade. It's a bacterium, depending on whether it's above or below the diaphragm, has between 2,000 and 6,000 immunological components, and you have trillions of them on your surface. I mean, vaccines are not just figurative. They are literally a drop in the ocean of which you encounter and manage every day. The notion that vaccines are weakening or overwhelming or perturbing the immune system is just, from an immunologist standpoint, fanciful.
Very good.
I'm a practicing pediatrician in Ontario, and I've been following the debate and the studies that have been done on the graduates of naturopathic colleges. In Ontario, the government has seen lose reality. They've now recognized naturopaths as a regulated health profession and also homeopaths. There's a college of homeopathy. In the study that was done in naturopaths, they looked at a four-year course. This is after they've had a four-year undergraduate degree. And the number of kids, number of graduates who've gone through those 4 years, something like, they were like 90% in favor of immunizations to begin with. By the time they graduate, there was like half of them believed in immunizations. I remember clearly there was a new graduate who practiced in Waterloo. Her main office was just getting going, so she decided to open up a clinic at the Good Life Fitness Club. And there were posters that went up in the Good Life Fitness Club talking about homeopathic nozodes. And the College of Naturopathy still does not have a regulation, a policy, or a standard that forbids their graduates, their licensees, from talking about vaccines in a positive way. In fact, the chiropractors said chiropractors can't talk about vaccines, period, after two kids died in a meningitis epidemic in 1997 that I was following closely. And that guy is still doing anti-vaccine work, despite the regulations that have been passed. I don't know what it's like in Quebec. I don't know what it's like in Alberta. But naturopaths are not licensed in every country, in every province of Ontario, of Canada. Any comments about the graduating naturopaths?
I think it's probably worth saying that a large number of the successful medical products that we have and that we use in, you know, what's called Western medicine, scientific medicine, originated in plant material, right? Quinines from the bark of a tree, and aspirin, similarly, bark and root of willow. So it seems much more likely that some of the naturopathic approaches have some validity to them as opposed to, for example, the homeopathic processes. I just wish that some of the naturopathic colleagues would accept a more scientific approach, and some of them are. There is an increasing number of reasonably well-done studies looking at natural products. Obviously, from a scientific Western medicine point of view, one would like to isolate the active components and try to put it into a pill. Naturopaths are naturally quite resistant to that because they view it as the industrialization of their profession, of their materials. But I think that it's probably not appropriate to tar all of the alternate medical approaches with the same brush. Having said that, I think that nozodes are absolutely ridiculous, and at this point I would probably blame the government of Canada for actually giving them registration numbers as opposed to the homeopaths and naturopaths who are promoting them.
Yeah, but their college refuses to do anything.
Okay, one more question.
Well, I'm sorry, I just want to add one thing to that. You said that the naturopaths, you know, whatever, 50% believed in vaccines. Vaccines aren't a belief system. They're an evidence-based system. You don't have to believe in them. There's a book by Stan Plotkin and Walt Ornstein called Vaccines. It's about 1,600 pages long. It has 20,000 references. I mean, it's read the book, read the references. You'll feel compelled. You'll feel convinced that vaccines are what they're claimed to be. I mean, any more than evolution is a belief system or gravity is a belief system. These are evidence-based systems. I mean, I think that Lazarus, you know, Lazarus was raised from the dead after he was buried for 4 days, that's a belief system. Or that the Moses parted the Red Sea, that's a belief system, because it violates the laws as we understand them of nature. I'm not saying don't believe it, I'm just saying it is a belief system. So I always bugs me, actually, when people say I don't believe in vaccines. You don't have to believe in them. I mean, the evidence supports them, right? This is evidence. We say evidence.
Another question on the back?
Yes, my question's for Dr. Ward. You mentioned that most people during that Disney measles outbreak were unvaccinated, but for the population that was vaccinated, I'm just wondering if outbreaks or an outbreak like this somehow reveals any vulnerabilities in the vaccines, and then also I'm just wondering how frequently the vaccines themselves are updated and if they're like, if they get better over time, I guess, or stuff like that.
Well, thanks for the question. When measles vaccine was first introduced, everyone believed that immunity following one dose of measles vaccine was lifelong. And that's clearly not true. It's a complicated system. It's a complicated situation when you introduce a vaccine into a population because for the first many years, depending upon the penetration of the vaccine into the community, you actually have an environment where you have mixed wild-type exposures with vaccine exposures. So many children get boosted by continued circulation of the wild-type virus. With a successful vaccination program over a number of years, gradually people become 100% reliant on the vaccine-induced immunity. I think at this point, well, in the 1990s, we learned that a single dose of vaccine in an era where the wild-type virus is no longer circulating reliably, boosting individuals, that you probably need a second dose of vaccine. And now we're a little bit further along, and there's some pretty reasonable evidence that even after two doses of vaccine, some people have waning immunity. So it's entirely possible that as we become a 100% vaccinated population with two doses of vaccine, that we may find ourselves, I'm speaking just now of measles, that we may need boosters later in life to provide complete protection from reintroductions from areas where they still have circulation of wild-type virus. That doesn't mean that the vaccines are bad. That simply means that we don't know everything about the vaccines when we introduce them. I think it was Dr. Heyman at the WHO who said that vaccination programs are like learning how to sail a boat, you know, while you're sailing it. And that's really what all of these vaccination programs are. They're very, very large clinical trials, and we don't know what the outcome is, but in most cases we know quite well what the consequences of not vaccinating are.
Okay, thanks very much for the questions. You have one?
He's been waiting.
Yeah.
I'm just a recently graduated medical student, and my question is for Dr. Ward. Apart from all the general public skepticism or hesitancy related to vaccination, there also seems to be some pushback even in like the professional societies in medicine or nursing or the paramedics who and the societies who are resistant to vaccination of, say, the influenza virus. And they think it's an infringement on their labor rights. What would you say to people who are, say, paramedics or nurses and refuse to be vaccinated and continue to work in a hospital or around sick and critically ill people? Thanks.
Paul and I have already talked about this a little bit, and we differ somewhat. I think it's a very, very complicated issue. My personal feeling is that if you have a good vaccine, you shouldn't need to convince people to receive it, that they will see the value of the vaccine for themselves, and in healthcare setting, they will see the value altruistically for the people they care for. The major problem with influenza vaccine right now is that we have to give it every year, and we have disastrous years like last year when it really just doesn't work very well because the virus drifts away from the product that's produced many months ahead of the season. My gut feeling is to stay away from compulsory vaccination, but I think Paul might want to say something about pro-compulsory vaccination.
Well, I can tell you what we did at our hospital. Brian's absolutely right. Last year was a bad match between the H3N2 circulating strain of influenza, and because it drifted right before that vaccine was right before the season started. So, but generally, generally you get 60 to 65% protection against moderate to severe disease. At our hospital, we had 35% immunization rates in the early 2000s. We had to sort of this pretty aggressive program to try and educate. That got us up to about 67%. Then we had a declination form, which basically read like it should have had a skull and crossbones on it. It said, you know, I know that as a healthcare worker, influenza can come into this hospital. I know that I can transfer it from one patient to the next. I know there are patients in this hospital who may not be able to be vaccinated. I know that when I transfer it from one patient to the next, that the patient I transfer it to could die from that infection, and 20% of people signed that form, that they didn't want to get it. Virtually all nurses, sadly. It was virtually all nurses. And then we had enough. There were two girls, both of whom in around 2003, 2004, both of whom had cancer, neither of whom came into the hospital with influenza, both of whom got influenza in the hospital, and both of whom died from influenza. Who protects them? It's our job to protect them. And I think we came to believe that it was not your right as a healthcare worker to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection. So in 2009, we mandated a flu vaccine. If you didn't get a flu vaccine, you had 2 weeks of unpaid leave to think about it. If you still didn't want to get a flu vaccine, you were fired. So we fired 9 people in 2009. But everybody's been, since then, people have been vaccinated. I think when you choose to work in the healthcare industry, knowing you're working around a vulnerable population of patients, it's your job to do that. I think Brian's right that in a better world, a world I'd like to point out in which we do not live, people would see the data and would be compelled by the data. But, absent that, then I think, is it their right to transmit the infection? I think the answer is no.
Okay, we have one last question.
I have two children with autism, and I am a pro-vaxxer, But what I hear from parents is they feel that they don't have, their doctors don't have enough time for them. They don't have enough time to ask questions and have their questions answered adequately. And then they go to the homeopath who has 2 hours or however long for them. And they feel, they leave the homeopath feeling that that person gets them. Do you think that if a traditional, if doctors, pediatricians had enough time, that maybe we could convince people, which seems in this province unlikely with the current changes? Do you think if we could maybe have longer consultation times, we could switch some people over?
You mean, you raise a really good point. I think that is part of this, the ability for, you know, the chiropractors and naturopaths and homeopaths to sell themselves. They do have more time. I mean, I watch my wife in private practice, you know, in pediatrics, and she'll see sometimes 40 or 50 patients a day. You know, that's just, it's impossible really to be able to spend the time doing just, you know, anticipatory guidance, much less answering more difficult questions about vaccines and autism. But you're right. I think the system is in some ways set up for failure. It's like, you know, driving in Boston, the home of, you know, no-fault insurance. You're bound to get into an accident because of those rotaries. And I think the same thing is true here. You're right. I'm not sure what the solution is, but you certainly hit on an important issue.
Ryan? No. Okay. Thanks very much for all those questions. And of course, for the answers as well. And tomorrow, it's on to GMOs and cell phones, and controversy to be sure. So we'll see you tomorrow.